Long ago, the Emperor foresaw humanity's need for warriors unlike any others. Warriors who could face the unbearable horror lurking among the stars. Who, when all others fled, would strike at that horror's very heart. Who, on the day of certain defeat, would be victorious. Brothers, we are those warriors. And that day is today.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. Today's topic is the Black Library's Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000 universe. And to discuss it, we are joined by author Josh Reynolds, who actually writes for the Black Library. Welcome aboard, Josh.
Thank you for having me, Van. How you doing?
Almost a decade ago, a professional freelance writer escaped from a maximum security stockade to the depths of the internet. Today, still wanted for crimes against publishing, he survives as a literary mercenary. If you have a book that needs to be written, if no one else can write it, and if you can find him via his easily navigable website, maybe you can hire Josh Reynolds. That's probably my favorite introduction so far, Josh. It is great to have you aboard. The Black Library's really come on in the last few years, and I was anxious to talk about it. Their Warhammer 40,000 stuff. And my first question is, because you are involved with them, and you're the only person I personally know that is, and you are American, yes?
Yes, I am, if you can't tell from the accent.
Right, and I believe you went to South Carolina?
Well, I was born in South Carolina, and went to the University of South Carolina and met my wife, who's English, at the university, and we got married, and she wanted to come back to England, so I came to England.
There you go. Okay, well, that makes sense. Right, yeah, because you're a fellow Southerner. Of course, I'm from Alabama originally.
Yeah.
And, well, that's interesting. So that's how you ended up. I thought that perhaps you had gotten pulled into the mechanism of the Black Library, and they had dragged you over there so that you could drink beer with Graham McNeil and Dan Abnett and you know, co-conspire in person in their plans to dominate the literary science fiction world.
you know, it that would have made a better story. But no, it's just a happy accident.
No, I understand. Actually. That's great. Okay, well, this is a really good topic this week. I'm very excited about this because over the last several years, I didn't think about it, but the way that I usually begin these shows is by asking my guests how they came to either be involved or interested in, you know, whatever it is we're talking about. And I'll kind of tell you my little boring version first, and I'm curious, yours may be just as boring, I don't know, but mine is that the game had been around for a while, but what really got me interested in it was I was playing the Babylon 5 card game with some guys near Atlanta, in a suburb of Atlanta. That was about 2000, 2001. And they had the Warhammer 40,000 card game. And I wasn't really familiar with it, and they said it was based on a miniature game, which I then saw people playing, and I had no interest at all. It looked neat, but that's just nothing I could ever be involved in. I just didn't want to.
Well, you know, it wasn't Babylon 5, so
yeah, this is true. And so, but I really liked the card game, and so that was when you could. There were only a few books out really, to compare to what there is now, and so I picked up you know, a couple of the early Gaunt's Ghost books from Dan Abnett, which was funny because I had to overcome my reluctance to read Dan Abnett back then, because all I'd ever read of his at the time was that atrocious Force Works run from the 90s. It's just abominable.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He's just infinitely better now at everything. But at the time, I was just like, oh, Dan Abnett, I don't know about that guy. Now he's one of my absolute three or four favorite authors in any field. But so, yeah, I came into it through the card game and started reading the books, and I think their publishing has just expanded just exponentially since then. How did you kind of first discover that whole universe, and then kind of how did you get involved in it?
Originally, I played the game. Mm-hmm. You know, I played Warhammer 40K, I played Warhammer Fantasy, I played Necromunda, Mordheim, all the satellite games. Mm-hmm. And my father was a big role playing game fan, and he's the one who introduced me to 40K and Fantasy back through the Warhammer Fantasy role playing game and the old Rogue Trader book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever seen that. Have you seen the old Rogue Trader book?
I've heard of it. I've seen maybe old copies in bookstores or something, yeah.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the stuff now, you owe it to yourself to find a copy of that book.
Hmm.
Because that thing is crazy. It is just the wildest, most out there science fiction, you know, setting you can imagine.
Well, what exactly is going on in it that's appealing? Help us understand.
Well, for 40K, the idea is that the universe is a dystopian nightmare.
Yeah. Yes. To put it mildly.
Yeah. It's I think one of my editors put it best when he said it's always 1 minute to midnight.
Yeah, that's good.
On the doomsday clock,
yeah.
for the 40K universe. Humanity has risen to great heights, and they're now on the downward, you know, the downward slide of their, you know, galaxy-spanning empire. Mm-hmm. The empire is a corrupt, monolithic, bureaucratic nightmare straight out of Franz Kafka. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's ruled by a corpse emperor that devours 100 million souls a day just to eke out another 24 hours of life. And humanity is surrounded by aliens, infiltrated by cults of demon-worshipping, you know, nihilists. And there are, you know, you've got the aliens, you've got the cults, and then you've got all the worst things out there that want to eat everyone. Aliens, humans, doesn't matter. They want to devour every living thing in the galaxy. And that's, you know, that is a perfect setting for a war game.
Absolutely.
Because if there is ever a setting designed to say let's everybody fight,
mm-hmm.
it's Warhammer 40K.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing I think that is very interesting, and we're going to touch on this more as we go along, is that this really is a fictional literary universe that operates largely in the service of the function of a game. In other words, you know, if I could put it in another context for a second, it's kind of like if you took the NFL and if there were just these fantastic novels about the NFL teams individually, and yet the whole thing is in service of playing games, having playoffs, and having a Super Bowl. You see what I'm saying? There's stories, but it's all in service of having them be able to fight each other in a game.
Well, I mean, it's like most tie-in fiction, it's a form of merchandising.
Yeah, but
so it's, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, obviously,
go
but
ahead.
But see, but that's what gets me, and that's one of the points I really want to make strongly on this episode, is that while it may have started out as the game comes first, and the books are sort of just merchandising that property and publicizing that property, I honestly feel like in the last few years it's kind of flipped on its head, because it seems to me that the books and the stories have, if anything, become more popular than the game.
Oh, there's. Well,
would you?
I was going to say there's no doubt about that.
Okay.
But I don't know whether I'm allowed to say that or not. So.
Okay. Well, I think the reason we can safely say that, whether you're allowed to or not, I understand completely, is because it is now like what, the fifth largest science fiction publisher in the world.
Yes.
And has had multiple New York Times bestsellers lately.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to say that something that's doing that is less popular than a tabletop miniature game.
Exactly.
Okay, so we can just use our logic and figure this kind of thing out, right? So I guess the point then is, this gets around to my other point that I'm going to kind of explore as we go along, which is, at what point does it become more of a burden on the fictional universe to have to be in the service of a pre-existing game story?
From personal experience, I can say it is not a burden so much as let me figure out a way to say this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a burden so much as there are clearly defined limits that you have to work within.
Okay.
So it's the game exists, the game and the lore, or the fluff, or whatever you'd like to call it, mm-hmm. exists to provide a framework that you work within.
Right.
So to call it a burden is to imply that the game itself, that the contributions of the game are a hindrance rather than something that we're building on.
That was inspiring.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, I like how you put that. I think that makes perfect logical sense, and I appreciate that. Okay. So I guess it helps me in a way, and also kind of hinders me in terms of all this, in that I haven't really read the game material, and so I really don't know what's coming up. Like, for example, with the Horus Heresy, and I know that in a second I'm going to have to stop and just explain what we're talking about to people that don't know. But and I'll do that in just a moment, listener, so hang on.
Wait, obviously they should go out and buy the books.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's the main thing. But
yeah.
For example, the Horus Heresy, they're going back and telling a sort of the prologue, the prequel material from 10,000 years earlier that kind of sets up the universe of Warhammer 40,000. Some people even call it Warhammer 30,000 or 30K. And
well, yeah, that is actually the official term for it.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, that story has long since been out in sort of abbreviated synopsis form, would you agree, in the game material?
Oh, yeah. It was actually originally, if I'm right, it was meant as page filler in one of the rule books.
Oh, no.
And then it developed into, it, like all good things, it developed a life of its own.
Okay.
And became founding mythology for the game.
Exactly. Okay. So if you've read like that page filler, one page thing or whatever that it started out as, you already know how the Horus Heresy allegedly ends. But since I haven't, I'm reading the books, hungrily devouring them as they come out, anxious to see how it ends, and yet I know that the ending is already predetermined, and it may not be an ending that I like because everything that's being done now is so sophisticated compared to, I think, how it began. I mean, again, like you said, it began as kind of like backstory for a game. That's not to minimize it. That's not to say that it wasn't worthy in its own right. But my point is, it began as something kind of more compact and smaller, and it's become more sophisticated. And as it's become more sophisticated, I'm worried that they're going to have to kind of cram a sophisticated body of work into an ending that is not as sophisticated. Does that make sense at all?
It does make sense, but I can tell you that you don't have to worry about that.
All right.
The original ending, I'm not going to tell you what happens.
No.
The original ending was written by Bill King,
mm-hmm.
who is a man I'm very proud to know.
Mm-hmm.
And the original ending is still beloved by fans of the Horus Heresy, fans of the Black Library, fans of 40K and fantasy, because of its sheer epic scope. It is literally a myth. You know,
mm-hmm.
he wrote it as a mythological epic ending to a six saga film.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when they finally get to that point in the books, they are going to have to fight to make what they write as good as what he wrote.
Wow. Well, there you go. Couldn't get a better endorsement than that.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, I had to kind of get that out of the way because that's something I've been wanting to talk to you specifically about for some time. But now, to kind of help people that are still listening and going, what are they talking about? A little background, I guess. I like to think of Warhammer 40,000 in particular as sort of the Marvel universe of dark apocalyptic science fiction.
That's a good way to put it.
In other words, you've got all kinds of characters, all kinds of different types of characters across the whole universe, and you can just kind of pick which little area to work in. You know, with Marvel, you've got like the Asgardian gods, the Greek gods. You've got Iron Man type characters. You've got Daredevil type characters. You know, you've got alien races that the X-Men deal with all the time, like the Shi'ar. You've got all these different things, and you can just kind of pick your own little swimming pool to play in. And Warhammer 40,000, to me, it seems very much similar to that, where you've got everything from the Space Marines, the Astartes, to the Imperial Guard for, like, the, you know, boots on the ground, regular grunt approach that Abnett does, for example, with the
Gaunt's Ghost.
Yeah, you've got you're getting a lot of the Space Marines in the Horus Heresy, obviously, and there's other stuff. There's the Inquisitor type stuff where you have these sort of religious fanatics that serve the God Emperor and kind of go out and prosecute or persecute anybody that doesn't follow the religious views of the Empire. And by the way, I've got to say, I thought that one of the things that they did with the Horus Heresy, and again, the Horus Heresy, taking you back 10,000 years, it's kind of the origin of where all this comes from. One of the things I thought that they did at the beginning of the Horus Heresy that was absolutely brilliant, and I've argued that it took me a couple of readings to really get it, but I think that the very first volume in that series, Horus Rising, is one of the best things Abnett has done and is absolutely brilliant, is that at the beginning of the whole thing, they're an atheistic empire.
Yeah.
And they're spreading like the gospel of science and reason and rationality. And that was very striking because if you've read all the Warhammer 40,000 stuff, it's a very religious, it's a fanatically religious empire that worships their like you said, their corpse emperor as a god. And yet back in the prequels, they specifically don't allow that. There are people that kind of want to, and they're not allowed. And so it's interesting to see how things change, how the views of the government change once the emperor, I guess, eventually is kind of removed from active involvement, you know, in the situation. What are your thoughts about that?
I actually quite that was one of that like you that was one of the things I greatly enjoyed about those first few books was the kind of the conflict between the Great Crusade, which is what's going on in the initial Horse Heresy books, where mankind is at its apex. You know, all of mankind across, you know, thousands of galaxies have been unified under the banner of the Emperor. Not the God Emperor,
just the Emperor, right.
And he's got his sons, the Primarchs, who are these genetically perfect supermen, leading legions of similar genetically perfect supermen out to establish, you know, a perfect scientific utopia. And then all of a sudden it all comes crashing down.
Yeah, this is what was so, again, what was so cool to me about the beginning of that prequel of the Horus Heresy is that they believe absolutely in science and reason and rationality.
Yes.
Though they have great psychic powers, but they just think of that scientifically. And they don't know anything about the supernatural. They don't believe in the supernatural. They don't believe there's anything supernatural out there. And they have just been winning everywhere they've gone. They've faced military forces and kind of like miniature civil wars, and they always prevail and bring these worlds back into the Union, basically. And so then when we pick up the story of the Horus Heresy, they've been doing this for 200 years, and suddenly they encounter the supernatural, which is sort of the chaos stuff, the demonic forces.
Yes.
And they are totally wrong-footed. They have no idea how to deal with it. And, of course, it's going to be the thing that proves to be their ultimate challenge, I guess, and nearly brings them down.
I would actually argue that it does, in fact, bring them down.
Well, Yeah. Well, I mean, Abnett kind of argues interestingly in the book Legion about that, when he kind of looks into the future and kind of says, do we have to lose in order to win, or can we win outright? And it's a very interesting puzzle.
Yeah, Legion is just it's probably one of the best books in the series.
Yeah, I agree.
It's all twisty and turning and crooked.
Yeah. So all right. So far, I think we've established that it's this dark apocalyptic universe where the human empire rules, but it's got a very tenuous hold because it is besieged day and night by enemies within and without.
Yes.
And they are both alien technological enemies, and they're different enemies over time. This is one of the things I also wanted to bring up. If you know, in the books, you've got the early days when the only real enemies are the Greenskins, which are kind of, we need to talk about where the earliest races come from, because they're kind of fantasy, they're kind of science fiction versions of fantasy races. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But you have a fairly limited number of enemies early on before chaos, the demons first appear. And then, you know, by the most far into the future Warhammer 40,000 stuff, you've started to add some of these races that are in the game that have come along in the last 10 years, like the Necrons and the Tau, who are much more science fictional future enemies. And they haven't even really shown up much in the books yet, have they?
Actually, they just this past, the past 2 months, they've gotten a very large push in the books. A couple of short stories. There was Firecast.
Yeah.
Firecase, everyone announced it came out. And then there were Shadow Sun, both of which people seem to have really enjoyed. And then a couple of short stories. So they're starting to get a little push now.
Yeah, I know it's true. I'd forgotten that the Tau have had sort of their own books, just like the Eldar kind of had their own books.
Yes.
But there hasn't. But I guess what I'm thinking of is, for example, Gaunt's Ghosts haven't really run into the Tau.
No, but that's also due to the ongoing, like the meta story arc of Gaunt's Ghosts, where they're engaged. They're in a single crusade. You know, they're fighting on one side of the galaxy.
Right.
Whereas the Tau are over here on this other fringe, fighting in that sector, because it really comes down to how much, you know, the galaxy is a huge place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's entirely possible to have characters fighting millions of light years away.
Yeah,
and for the way the ships travel, through the warp, and the warp plays funny tricks on your perception of time and how much time passes. You can actually exit the warp. Like if you're going to a battle, you're going to a world that's under siege, and you're on a ship, and the ship goes through the warp to reach that world that's under siege, you can actually come out of the warp before the siege begins. Or you could come out of the warp 50 years after the siege has begun.
Right.
So it's kind of like Doctor Who. Time is a big ball of wibbly wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Yeah.
With the way they travel, it's not like Star Trek where they zip forward and there they are.
Right.
It's more like you go through a steaming ectoplasmic ocean full of nightmare entities that are trying constantly to get into the ship and eat the souls of every single crew member and passenger.
Yeah, and I was actually going to mention that always reminds me of the Event Horizon movie.
Yes.
It's so funny when I first watched Event Horizon, I've got it on Blu-ray now, I was like, this is a Warhammer 40,000 movie.
Pretty much. If you combined Event Horizon and the Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah.
That pretty much gives you kind of an idea of the stylistic element.
Yeah, that's interesting. But much better written than the Chronicles of Riddick, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, stylistically, I think that's right.
Well, there are a lot of things better written than the Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah, well, that's the truth. All right, well, let's see. So, one other thing I wanted to note about sort of the style, since we're talking about stylistic and everything, is that it, and I've had other people observe this to me too, and sometimes they consider this a good thing, sometimes a bad thing, or just a thing, is that the overall sort of look and feel of a lot of Warhammer 40,000 is very British. You can tell that this was a British thing and not an American thing, because I would argue that American sort of military science fiction has a very kind of a kind of a oorah, gung ho. It's very Marines, you know, like I think about like David Weber and John Ringo and David Drake. It's very sort of clean and crisp, almost. It's hard for me to find words to describe what I'm trying to describe, but it's very almost clean cut and pure, and doesn't involve itself in a lot of social things. For example, it doesn't get bogged down in the social mores and background. Whereas with Warhammer 40,000, it's almost in a way like Victorian England reborn in the far future. Does that make any sense? I'm asking you that question a lot because I'm just kind of groping in the dark here. I want to make sure that
sense. That does make perfect sense. Okay. And I think it's the British have a greater tradition of dystopic fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And Warhammer as a whole, 40K and fantasy, were both drawing a lot of inspiration from the writers of the new wave in science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
So a lot of Michael Moorcock, you know, writers of that caliber who have that kind of juxtaposition of the military and the social and how one affects the other. Whereas, you know, American military science fiction writers are generally concentrating on the military.
Yeah, I was...
Not necessarily without concern for the social.
Right.
But the social is less important than giant tanks.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In a lot of American military science fiction that I've read, you get a lot more emphasis on the technology. Yes. Whereas in British, it's almost more like if you've seen or read the Bernard Cornwell's the thing that Sean Bean does, the Sharp. Yeah, it's almost more of that. Well, he's an officer, but he's not. But he's a commoner. In the early Gaunt's Ghost books, there was a lot of that. I'm glad they've kind of gotten away from it. And a lot of the Warhammer stuff, they've kind of gotten away from it. I haven't seen much of that in the Horus Heresy, but early on, I was kind of irked by it because I'm not a big fan of the whole. It just seems like in a lot of British fiction, they rehash this a lot, so I'm glad that Warhammer's kind of gotten away from it now. But they rehash this story of the commoner who gets raised up to be somebody important, but all of his superiors still regard him as lesser, except for his one patron who protects him and shields him. And, I mean, that's exactly the Sharp story. And it was Gaunt at the beginning. Gaunt was basically Sharp in a way at the beginning. He had like the one war master, whoever that was kind of that liked him and was protecting him, you know, but otherwise they were all like, who's this guy? And why don't we just send his army off to be killed, you know? So I'm glad they've kind of gotten away from that a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's kind of the underlying theme of British fiction.
Yeah.
It's you know, like the American underlying theme of the great American novel is self-made man.
Yes.
Whereas the, you know, kind of one of the underlying themes of British fiction and a lot of European fiction is the idea of someone jumping social class.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's a British game. It's a British company. It's a British publisher with mostly British writers. So
yeah, exactly.
British themes will be prevalent.
But I do think that it's changed. It's gotten beyond that in the last few years. I haven't seen nearly as much of that lately. I think it's really started to focus more on the story and on the characters and the individual situations rather than that sort of larger kind of underlying tension. And I welcome that if that's the case, at least for what I've read.
Well, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the characters have evolved.
Yeah.
It's a continuous series where characters die, characters are born. There are characters in Gaunt's Ghosts now who were children in like some of the earlier books.
Yeah.
And they're almost adults now. So, you know, the story has evolved and changed. Gaunt is no longer the upstart commissar general.
Right.
You know, he's a respected commissar general who has undertaken deadly missions, and his people have been tried and tested. They're no longer a regiment that was just founded. They're a regiment that's participated in some of the most horrific conflicts in the galaxy. So their challenges and the challenges they face from within their own social structure have changed.
Yeah.
And evolved.
So. And they've lost a number of members along the way. I liked how Abnett put, somebody asked him, how long are you going to write the Gaunt series? And he said, I guess until I run out of ghosts.
Because he's running out of them fast.
He is, yeah. So, well, I wanted to touch on this. I mentioned earlier that the Warhammer 40,000, the sort of the races, and you have to think of it that way because, again, remember, if it starts out as a game, then you pick a race to play. So you can be there's different types of humans that you can be, or you can be, like I said, the Tau or the Necrons, or you can be there's other races. It started out with, like, what, four or five that were borrowed directly from the fantasy game. The fantasy game is kind of like if you took the Lord of the Rings but then amped it up into that more sort of apocalyptic, you know, on the edge of destruction every day, I guess. How would you describe the Warhammer 40? How would you describe the Warhammer fantasy setting compared to, like, the Lord of the Rings or something like that?
Well, it's a lot nastier than the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly.
It's basically, I hesitate to say it because I think it does it a disservice, but it's the Lord of the Rings filtered through Michael Moorcock.
Okay.
It's filtered through that grimy, nasty. It's the griminess and nastiness of Fritz Lieber's Fafhrd and the Grey Mauser stories. Mm. You know, where you can taste the dirt on the street.
Yeah.
You know, not that you should lick a street, but
and
you know.
Certainly not one there.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know what's on those cobblestones, but. It's an epic fantasy universe brought down to a dark fantasy or a sword and sorcery level. So you have elves, you have dwarves, you have dragons and magic, but it's all done through this Robert E. Howard, Fritz Lieber kind of prism. So it's, you know, people die from dysentery in the Warhammer fantasy universe, where they don't, you know, people don't die from dysentery in Lord of the Rings.
They don't even use the bathroom.
No, but in fantasy, you know, in the old Warhammer fantasy role playing game, your character, you could create a character who would have leprosy because that was a thing. Like I had a character I created when I first started playing Warhammer fantasy. When I first started playing the role-playing game as opposed to the war game.
Right, the miniatures, right.
Yeah, I played, you know, it was like Dungeons & Dragons. It was a role-playing game. I sat down and created a character. My character wasn't a warrior or a wizard or anything like that. He was a rat catcher. He was a dude who caught rats, and he had leprosy. That's what I rolled up. That's what I had to play. And that tells you all you need to know about Warhammer Fantasy is it's the nasty underbelly of an epic fantasy universe.
Right. And so when they created a science fiction version of it, they literally created a science fiction version of it, right?
Well, that was the brief, was you take all the races from fantasy and you stick it in science fiction.
Mm-hmm. You keep...
So there were space elves, there were space orcs, there were space dwarves.
Space marines, which are basically knights, right?
Yeah. Space marines, the Imperial Guard... And a whole buttload of aliens.
Yeah. but you had chaos in the Warhammer universe too, right? I mean, it was just like came from like the North Pole or something.
In the fantasy universe, what originally happened was the world was essentially chaos is like almost like H.P. Lovecraft's Great Old Ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's energy. It's something from outside the universe. Bursting in and trying to swallow this world. And so every race, whether evil or good or not particularly concerned about alignment, are fighting a war, whether they know it or not, to prevent their world from drowning in chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like with 40K, it's inevitable that they will lose. They're going to lose. They're not going to win, but they still fight.
Well, and like I said, that book Legion in the Horus Heresy series, not to spoil too much, but did kind of give us hope that maybe in loss can come another victory, perhaps, or something like that.
Exactly.
So, okay.
Well, I mean, in the fantasy universe, for instance, there are people who live with chaos. They live with mutation. They live in a harsh wasteland where cities are born and die in the space of an hour, and flowers talk to people, and they live in this world, and they're fine. You know, humans adapt to anything.
Yeah.
they get along fine. You know, it's only because they're opposed to the characters we traditionally think of as heroes that they're evil.
Well,
and the fact that they're, you know, ravening baby-eating mutants.
I was going to say, and Chaos also, from everything I've read, is very good at PR. They're very good at making themselves seem like something you would find desirable, but there's always that sort of stench of brimstone under the surface, you know, so...
Well, and I mean, the Chaos powers themselves are derivative of humans. So they're something we created, to a certain extent. At least in the fantasy universe, they're something that came from humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Chaos powers, as the major powers, the things which actively take an interest in human affairs, are things that draw their strength from us.
Hmm.
So their rage and lust,
right,
and, you know, hope. Like the Chaos power Tzeentch, the changer of ways, the lord of change.
Mm-hmm.
That the Chaos power, it draws its power from hope. You know, it is literally an evil entity that requires people to hope for something better. because that's where it gets its power.
Interesting.
From. That's what it wants. It wants you to hope and plan for the future. Because that, you know, that's how it exists.
Hmm.
That's what it feeds off of.
So it wouldn't serve it very well to wipe out humanity, because then it wouldn't have any food.
Any hope. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They don't want to wipe humanity out. They just want to change humanity into something we might not recognize,
right,
as being human.
So when they moved all that over to the science fictional universe, they had to kind of make a more of a scientific sort of rationale for it, and so we got sort of the Eye of Terror, which I love, this idea of this, like this swirling maelstrom black hole thing called the Eye of Terror, that basically it leads into basically hyperspace, right? But hyperspace is not like, you know, white puffy clouds like in Star Wars or something. Hyperspace in Warhammer 40,000 is more like where those demonic chaos creatures actually live. Was that about right?
It's actually, going back to your comic book analogy,
mm-hmm,
the Eye of Terror is the entrance to the negative zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the antimatter universe. It's where everything that is good is evil. You know.
But they travel through it to go places in the ships, right?
They travel through the warp. They don't travel through the Eye of Terror. If you go in the Eye of Terror, you don't come back out. The Eye of Terror is essentially a place where the warp has exploded out into this, the galaxy.
Right, okay, yeah. Well, it looked like Perturabo was able to travel into the Eye of Terror. But...
well, yeah, because that's before they knew what it was.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Although he named it. I thought that was interesting, because he named it, so...
Yeah.
Okay, so... So they bring Chaos, they bring the elves over, and they're the Eldar, which I think is a pretty cool name. They brought the orcs over, but they don't show up very often in 40,000. It doesn't seem like anymore. They've developed some more reasonable science fictional alien menaces than just, you know, big hulks with big stupid guns or something.
I love
it. I knew you were going to say that.
I love them.
Well, tell the listeners exactly what the orcs are in the Warhammer 40,000 sci-fi version. And we're out of time for this week's episode. So if you will come back next week and join us for part two of Josh Reynolds and the Black Library, we'll find out the strange origin and purpose of the orcs, which I had no idea about and is fascinating. And we will go on and delve into all the other dark corners of the darkest of universes, the Warhammer 40,000 and related universes from the Black Library. So our time is up, and as always, we thank you for yours. We will see you guys and gals down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.